Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. In the United States, a very small percentage of people control the vast majority of personal wealth. One of the most startling statistics find that people at the top one-tenth of 1%, have about the same amount of money as the bottom 90%. What would happen if the wealthiest Americans took a significant portion of their money out of the stock market and invested it instead in creating lasting social change? Is it possible for the 99% and the 1% to work together to create a more equitable distribution of wealth? Chuck Collins thinks so. He's the author of Born on Third Base, and he joins me now to talk about some of the ideas he outlines in his book. Chuck Collins, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Marianne. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We'd also like to hear from you. What do you think of the distribution of wealth in the United States? Should it be fixed? If so, how? Chuck Collins, you say in your book that we're living in the equivalent of economic apartheid. How so?
Well, for over 30 years, we have just been pulling apart both income, wealth, and opportunity, really. And, you know, it's almost like 100 years ago, the first Gilded Age. And if we just keep going the way we are going to become kind of a racial and economic apartheid society if we just let the inequality machinery keep going.
So there are there's a small group of people out there who have a lot of opportunity, whereas there's a very large group of people out there who have far fewer opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've looked at is really the bottom 50% of households in the United States have not really shared in the big productivity boom of the last couple of decades. And that top one-tenth of 1%, as you say, just has been delinking, really pulling apart from the rest of society. And that wouldn't be so bad, except that that group has enormous political and cultural and philanthropic power to shape the priorities of the culture.
Mm. The title of your book comes from the Barry Switzer quote, "Some people are born on third base and go through life thinking they hit a triple." And you write that you yourself were born on third base, but you figured that out pretty quickly. You even went so far as to give away your inheritance when you were just 26. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a wealthy suburb of Detroit. I'm the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. Mm. So I'm from a four-generation-old family. But in my early 20s, one of my first jobs is I worked with mobile home park residents who were trying to buy their parks. In fact, I worked with some groups in Minnesota. And one of the things that gave me was an insight into, in the 1980s, just what was happening to people's wages, how flattening out wages was really stressing people out. And at the same time, coming from a wealthy family, I could see how wealth was multiplying, how my own wealth and assets and people that I knew was compounding as well. So I had this very intimate front row seat to how inequality was opening up. So when I started to read and understand the larger economic issues, it was very, very personal. And I sort of made a decision to not, you know, go not to have an inheritance, to give that wealth away, to give it to several foundations. And it allowed me to kind of unflinchingly look at the trends as they've unfolded really the last 25 years.
What did you learn from the experience once you did give the gift away? Was there a sense of, oh, wait, why did I just do that? Or was it, oh, this is freeing and liberating?
Actually, one of the things I learned is just how much other advantage I have that was not tied to the money. I mean, coming from, you know, four generations of economic stability, I'm white, I'm male, I got a debt-free college education, which, as we know today, is a great head start. I don't have to worry about my parents. There's like a mountain of other advantages and privileges that were almost kind of wired into my life. So I would say one of the things I learned, everybody thought, oh, well, you're giving your wealth away. That's like you're jumping off a cliff. what I realized is I was just sort of walked downhill a step, but it wasn't like a radical change.
Hmm. We're talking this hour with Chuck Collins. He's the author of the book Born on Third Base. And we're talking about wealth inequality in the United States and what a change to that could look like. It takes the involvement of people at the top and at the bottom. If you'd like to join the conversation with your thoughts about wealth redistribution, give us a call on 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. If you are a member of the 1%, are you willing to give up 30, 40, 50% of that for social change? You can also reach us online at mprnews.org/live. Chuck Collins, who are the 1%? Are they a group apart or just like everybody else?
Well, you know, as you climb the ladder, and actually in Born on Third Base, I write about what I call the roadmap to Richistan. So really, there are people in the top 10% of income and wealth holders, and they're affluent and comfortable and living in generally, you know, comfortable lives. As you climb that ladder, you're getting toward kind of more wealth dynasties, families that have substantial wealth, CEOs of major companies. One of the things we've learned is that in the 80s and 90s, a lot of the inequality of income and wealth was a function of wage income, meaning earnings, people who are getting enormous, you know, paychecks. Now it's a function of capital. It's owning and controlling wealth that is now creating more wealth. So we're now moving into what I would call sort of a hereditary dynasty phase of inequality. And that's really in the top half of the top 1%.
Mm. And how much of once you get to that position of being wealthy and accumulating, that you have this capital that is snowballing with interest in the markets, how much of a bubble do you end up living in as a result of that?
It's very, very different. The stereotype or the image of, you know, kind of the monopoly man, wealthy person doesn't really help us understand that a lot of wealthy people live nearby. They don't have they're not that disconnected. Some of them are very involved in civic life or they don't fit the part. At the very, very top, I mean, in Billionaireville, we are talking about people who have multiple homes and are kind of globalized in their wealth. They've hired a kind of a wealth defense industry, if you will, of lawyers and planners and lobbyists whose job is to help them maintain and expand their wealth and pass it on to subsequent generations. That group is somewhat delinked, except some of them are very involved in philanthropy and in trying to fix problems. So it's not at all a monolithic group is what I would say.
You talk in the book about sort of the lack of empathy in the top 1% and the sense of, well, I deserve this, I earned this, the meritocracy that goes about with that. Talk to me a little bit about that. Is there just a certain amount of denial that is built up because you're surrounded by people who have the same amount of wealth and feel similarly to you? Is there, you know, what does it feel like to belong to the 1%?
Well, I think that it actually, people feel the impact of the inequalities we're living in, that it's very, very painful to live in an unequal society.
Even at the top?
So, even at the top. But here's what I would say wealthy people do. One is they have the ability to disconnect, so they can step back into enclaves of privilege and not have to feel it. Or they adopt powerful stories, or I would say myths, of deservedness. So you're walking down the street or you're getting driven down the street and you see poverty and deprivation, you say, you either feel some pang of empathy or you're kind of emotionally shut down, or you have a story that says, well, I'm where I am because I deserve to be here because I worked harder, smarter, I got up earlier, or my family worked harder and smarter. So I'm comfortable living inside this myth of deservedness, and those people who don't have wealth didn't work as hard, you know. So, and I would argue that that powerful myth is one of the things that holds inequality in place, and it's one of the things that wealthy people can do to change the situation is to tell true stories about how advantage works in our society.
to recognize how they got where they are a little bit more fully than just it's by the sweat of my brow.
Yeah, to sort of give name to the sort of web of commonwealth or the commons of that makes individual wealth possible. You know, the fertile ground that we create through public investments and education and infrastructure and knowledge, all of that. You know, without that, there is very little private wealth.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. You can reach us with your call if you'd like to join the conversation at 651-227-6000. Again, that's 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. Again, that's 1-800-242-2828. Melissa is on the line from Minneapolis. Melissa, thanks so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having the conversation. I really appreciate the topic.
You bet. What would you like to share with us?
Well, I think a way to kind of redistribute some of the wealth in America is for Americans to recognize that African Americans deserve some sort of reparations for slavery. The title of the book is, Third Base. However, African Americans, we are benched in this game of life, right? We are not even on the field. Mm. And when I say reparations, the first thing folks say is, well, you know, you want us to write you a big fat check. And it's not just about that check. It's about the things in life that are holding us back. So what about maybe student loan forgiveness, right, in order for us to get ahead? Maybe wipe my credit report clean and give me a starting chance. And then maybe write me a check at the same time, you know. And the UN actually in September of 2016 said the UN did a report and said that the United States owes African Americans reparations, you know. And when we discuss this, this is like a taboo topic, reparations.
Yeah. Yeah. Melissa, thank you so much for your call. And in fact, Chuck Collins, you devote at least a chapter on racial reparations in your book.
Yeah, I appreciate Melissa's call, and it reminds me, one of my black friends says, I was born in the dugout. But, you know, she's absolutely right. We can't really move forward in this country until we acknowledge what Randall Robinson calls the debt to African Americans, not just for slavery, but Jim Crow, separate and unequal, decades of discriminatory housing policy right up to the current moment. The racial wealth divide, and this is something that I study in my day job at the Institute for Policy Studies, you know, is enormous, and it's deep and structural and rooted in this legacy of racism. And it cannot be overcome just by saying, oh, well, we'll just have a first-time homebuyers program over here that will help first-time homebuyers. It requires, as Melissa says, a more of a repair or reparations investment. And again, it doesn't have to be in the form of like, okay, we're just going to write checks. It could be building institutions, supporting historically black colleges, first-time homebuyer programs that understand how race works in real estate and homeownership, forgiveness of student loans. Some of those things can be universal, meaning they can apply to everybody that's been excluded. But in order to really face the deep kind of racial history that we have to understand that the wiring has to be different given the legacy of racism. So in Born on Third Base, I definitely make the case that we should, you know, support H.R. 40, which would create a commission to study the impact of slavery and make recommendations. And a lot of my friends will say, well, you know, I'm like my family. We're Irish and German immigrants. We showed up in the 1880s. We weren't here. But as white Americans, we benefit from this system of white privilege. Now, some people are going to hear that and say, well, you know.
Yeah, I can hear. I can imagine a low-income white person saying.
Yeah, I'm in the bottom 50%. Yeah. I'm struggling. I would argue that the wealthiest people in the society, people like from, you know, in the 1%, have a special obligation. Our bank accounts have a racial premium, if you will, that comes from this generational transfer. So I would argue we should institute sort of a wealth tax that would be one of the primary funding sources for a reparations program. Many working people haven't benefited from this economy, whether they're white, black, or brown. So I think it should be, we should address reparations through the lens of the great inequalities in our society right now.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got TJ on the line from Rochester. Welcome to the conversation, TJ.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, I'm very well, thank you. I just, it seems like people have their hands out. I just told the gal when I, you know, when she talked to me, I said, I make, for a couple of years now, I've been making $50,000 a year, and I never, you know, made that before. And my wife's retired, and we've got insurance on good kind of junk, but, you know, we're lower middle income, whatever, I suppose. I don't know. We don't have all that much money, but I think I'm rich. You know, I don't need people to give me money. I've worked up four jobs at one time. And I understand there's people that can't do that. You know, and we should help them. And rich people, just like everybody else, has a moral responsibility to help other people. But so they made that money, and they've done whatever they've done to keep it. And, you know, let them keep it. Why should I be taking money from people that made their own money? You know?
All right, TJ, thanks for that. What do you think TJ's argument, Chuck?
Yeah, I just appreciate his hard work and efforts. And what I would just say is, what happens at this point, the inequalities we're living through are not a difference in effort and, deservedness. It's a function of how the rules of the economy have been changed over 30, 40 years. So what I would say to TJ is, a lot of the wealth that's funneling to the top is a function that the rules of the economy have been changed to benefit asset owners, wealth holders, at the expense of people like TJ who work for wages. And that's just continuing to compound. And part of my argument here is that these inequalities are actually bad for everybody. When we pull apart the way we are, it undermines the health of the economy, democracy, obviously, when wealthy people have such power in the culture and society. It undermines our health and social cohesion and community solidarity. It undermines the things we really care about, including for people who are very wealthy, that if we just keep going the way we are, this will backfire. This will undermine this fragile American experiment of self-governance and economic freedom. And so my argument to the 1% is, look, we don't want to go down this road. It is not in anyone's interest. And that's why I really say, bring the wealth home. Bring the wealth out of the speculative stock market and put it back into the communities, into the main street economies that hire people like TJ, not the speculative paper economy that is bringing our standard, bringing our lives to the brink of instability.
Now, this is not your first book on this topic. I mean, how has this message been received?
What I'm finding is, I'm talking to wide audiences of people, but I'm also talking to, people in the 1% and philanthropic groups. What I'm seeing is people are waking up to this message. It's not just inequality. It's sort of understanding that the ecological crisis we're on the brink of living through is also going to destroy the foundations of wealth. So it's sort of a moment when it's actually in the selfish interests of people who are in that top 1% group to figure out how to help realign society and help us make this transition. So, and I think with the current election, there's a lot of people waking up who in the past had been just kind of disengaged, who are saying, wait a second, we're about to accelerate the inequalities we're living in. That's not in my interest.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Steve on the line from Minneapolis. Steve, welcome.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for this conversation.
Absolutely.
So the short story is that I grew up in a pretty poor family, broken family, and we were on welfare for a time. And I started working about the age of 16 to start my own companies. And I've been in the 1% for, I suppose, about the last decade. And I guess a couple of things that feel like are never talked about is that the vast majority of the 1% are actually small business owners.
Mm.
And they're people who work really, really hard. This is someone in the 1% expressing frustration about people in the upper tenth of 1% who I see having a disproportionate amount of power and influence through their, you know, panzer divisions of attorneys that bait our politicians in cash and actually influence policy and get loopholes and all that, where the little guys in the 1%, which is me, are just really hardworking people. And in my case, I paid out, you know, $400,000 in income taxes last year. And it feels kind of like that hurts a lot. But it also feels like that should speak to the concept of giving back. And I so wish that I had influence to tell the government how to spend that money, because for me, it'd be social programs, it'd be education, it'd be less military, it'd be all sorts of things that it's not. But, you know, I gave up my 20s and 30s to 80 to 120-hour work weeks and made huge sacrifices. And I'm not here to complain about it, but that's what it took for me to get to the 1%. So I just wanted to kind of lay that out there as a perspective on this small class of people that really worked hard, that I don't feel like I benefited a lot from just the fact that I'm a white guy, but I could be wrong.
All right. Steve, thank you so much for sharing your story. Chuck?
Well, I think Steve's is a beautiful story, and it illustrates an important part of the dynamic. Okay, so we do have people like Steve who are entrepreneurs, whether they're first generation or they've been here a while or they start in poverty, as he describes, and they make these heroic and amazing sacrifices and they build up companies. This is what we should be celebrating. This is what we should be lifting up. And yet we now have this system where this top one-tenth of 1%, or those of us who come from what I would call wealth dynasties, who haven't kind of created the value that Steve has created, are dominating the politics and setting the policy. And he colorfully described the, you know, the Panzer, the wealth defense industry, which, you know, is kind of an army. That one-tenth of 1% is now taking their money offshore, hiding it in trusts. They pay zero taxes, very little taxes. They're the hugest wealth depository, and they pay considerably less than Steve. The one thing I would say to Steve is, you know, he did make individual sacrifices, and those should be rewarded. And we live in a marvelous society with a kind of public investment infrastructure that makes wealth possible, particularly for people who came out of the post-World War II era and into the 80s and 90s. We got to ride a wave, if you will. So it's not to take away anything from his individual effort, but just to look at this wave that we're riding. And not everybody gets a surfboard on that wave. And not everybody has the same doors open to them. So that's not to take away anything from individual effort. We should celebrate that. But we should just see this context that makes individual wealth creation possible. And we want an economy that creates more Steves and not more, you know, wealth dynasties of 5-7 generations of wealth holders who use their power to get more wealth and power.
Yeah, and to Steve's credit, he paid his $400,000 in taxes, which is, as you say, unusual amongst the higher ranks. You want to see more people putting their money back into their taxes.
Yeah, and he doesn't resent it. I mean, he's saying he wants to see it used in his communities to address urgent needs. That is not an uncommon sentiment. We hear the anti-tax voices. We hear I shouldn't have to pay anything back to those people kind of arguments. He's making a much more powerful argument. And I would just, you know, underscore, he's paid his fair share. And maybe more than his fair share, given the fact that we have, you know, thousands of multimillionaire households in this country that pay considerably less or even no taxes because they figured out how to game the system.
So what exactly would you like to see the top 1% or one-tenth of 1% do with their money?
Well, I do think we should restore the progressive tax system we had after World War II. I think we should have a very robust inheritance tax. So I'm a supporter of the estate tax, or what some people call the death tax. It should be even more progressive than it is, meaning if you have, you know, $100 million fortune, you should pay a higher percentage than someone with $5 million. We should have a higher stage of income tax brackets. So I mentioned taxation because we're not going to solve the big problems that we have through charity, but I encourage people to give back through philanthropy and charity. But unfortunately, a lot of philanthropy now is actually compounding the inequalities, not getting at the root causes of the problems. Very little money goes to groups like whatever the Headlands, the Headwaters Foundation in Minnesota, you know, that does actual grassroots social change work, and a lot of it is going to reproduce privilege. So basically, bring the wealth home is pay your fair share of taxes, speak out publicly for a fair tax system, share, give your money through philanthropy, and tell true stories of how wealth came to be possible. And lift up and recognize not just the individual sacrifice, but the ways in which we together create a remarkable, fertile ground for wealth creation in this society.
You're listening to NPR News. We're talking this hour with Chuck Collins. He's the author of Born on Third Base. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Carl on the line in Pine Island. Carl, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'd like to say I really appreciate Mr. Collins's his efforts. He's very much like Warren Buffett's ideas on fair taxes and Nick Hanauer's wage income. But my question is, that all flies in the face of an ideology of trickle-down theory, which I've never seen really work. How does he feel about that?
Okay, Carl, thanks. Chuck Collins, what do you think of trickle-down taxation, the idea that, you know, this will all benefit everybody eventually?
Well, I think we've been kind of living through that theory for a couple of decades, this idea that we're going to cut taxes on the wealthy and that that's going to be invested in some way that's productive and that that's going to grow the economy and benefit everyone. You know, just to underscore, in the last 40 years, the size of the economy has doubled. The bottom half of wage earners have not shared. Wages are, for the bottom 50% are the same as they were in the late 70s. That should tell us that trickle-down isn't trickling down if a half of wage earners are excluded from the growth and productivity of the last 40 years. So, you know, I agree with Nick Hanauer and others who say, look, the way to really grow the economy is to invest in expanding the middle class. You know, after World War II, we provided debt-free education to millions of people, first-time home buyer loans, 1% 40-year fixed-rate farmers' home loans. You know, our parents and grandparents in Minnesota and the North Country got farmers' home mortgages that put them on the wealth-building train. And we could do that again. We could refocus. And it's the middle-class consumers that drive economic growth. It's middle-class spending. Low-income people, when they get opportunities, they invest in their local community or they spend their money in a local community. So it's a flawed theory. You know, of course there's productive investment among the wealthy, but there's also a huge amount of speculative, non-productive investment that really doesn't help the real economy.
I should note that you wrote this book in 2016 and it was published before the presidential election. And we now have Donald Trump in office who, are you talking about taxation? I don't think we still haven't seen his taxes, his tax records. And he has several billionaires in his cabinet. So what do you think of the tone in the nation now around wealth and power versus, say, when you were writing this book?
Well, I think I would have. I think this election was about inequality. You know, I think both the rise of Bernie Sanders was sort of the populist, the progressive populist expression of that. When you have a society that's polarized economically, it leads to a polarized politics. And the rise of Donald Trump isn't that surprising. You know, again, half the population hasn't shared, and a lot of those people are in rural communities and communities that have been left behind. The problem is his program is not going to address the real underlying problems for that bottom half of the population. It's probably going to worsen them. I mean, we do know he wants to deregulate the financial sector. That's not going to help the bottom 50%. He wants to cut taxes. He wants to eliminate the estate tax entirely.
Mm-hmm.
He's proposing essentially tax breaks that will give the richest 1% I saw an estimate $6 trillion of tax cuts over the next 10 years. So we're actually on the verge of moving into hyper inequality mode if some of these policies go through.
And do you think, in looking at this, and as you work on your own efforts, does this feel sort of like a blow when you see the concept of the estate tax being eliminated entirely, and you devote chapters with, you know, on how your work with Bill Gates Sr. and saving the estate tax and building it up?
You know, it is a blow because I think that what people really want, what most people in this, as I understand it, even some of those who voted for Donald Trump, want an economy that works for everybody. They want to share in the productivity. And so it's a huge betrayal. People may not feel betrayed yet, but I think they will. And the deeper the ruts of inequality go, the harder it is going to be to reverse it. But we're getting the patriotic millionaires and all these groups, the band is getting back together to defend the estate tax from repeal again. We're going to be right back at it. And I think we want these arguments and this discussion to be right at the center of it, which is, you know, what do wealthy people owe a society that's made it almost entirely possible for them to grow this wealth? How do these inequalities undermine the quality of life for everybody? Is this really the road we want to go down? So I think the Trump economic program is going to be rolling at us in the coming weeks, and it's a real opportunity to wake up and speak out.
Let's talk a little bit about the antagonism between the 99% and the 1%, probably most visibly demonstrated with the Occupy movement. Was the Occupy movement effective?
Well, it was really important in terms of putting these issues of inequality kind of more central on the American agenda. And I think that the notion of the 99 to 1, as much as that sounds like an antagonistic frame, you know, the 99 versus the 1%, it's a fairly accurate description of the divide. Although, as Stephen, the caller, and I would probably agree, it's really the 1/1000th.
Right.
And the 99.9% where the real power differential opens up. So I think the Occupy movement was powerful. And I think that it's now, you know, what we know is there's a huge realignment happening in American politics, and in part because of these inequalities. And I have some optimism that, you know, we will continue to lead to a realignment, and we'll be able to push for an economy of shared prosperity again, just, you know, in the same way after World War II, 30 years of shared prosperity, initially exclusively for whites, but, you know, by the 60s and 70s, the rising tide was lifting all boats. The middle class was expanding, and we know how to do that. We can go back to that. So I don't think we have to accept these inequalities as determined at all.
But you've also said
it really depends on what we all do, actually.
You also say you've waged class warfare and it doesn't work.
Well, what I would say is I was part of saying, yeah, the 1% or the super rich and the billionaires. I guess what I've learned is there are some allies in the room. There are obviously people who use their wealth and power to get more wealth and power, but that's a pretty small segment of the super rich. And actually, there's a lot of other people who are behind the scenes trying to work for a more equitable society. And then the reason I think I've changed my tune is because there's all these people who are kind of on the fence, and we want them to be engaged. We want them to bring their wealth home and reengage in places, you know, a place like Minnesota as a place. And bring your wealth out of the casino economy and the offshore tax havens and put it back into the real economy and put your stake in the health of the society for everyone. And that's where I see, you know, the anger, rage, and hate towards the rich as actually not really helping engage the people we want at the table.
Yeah, you say compassionate pressure is where it's at.
Yeah, I think so. I think there are people waiting to be engaged and invited to the table, and they don't know how to relate to it. You know, people should check out networks like Resource Generation, where younger people with wealth, entrepreneurial wealth and inherited wealth are getting together, the Patriotic Millionaires. There are networks where people are coming together to organize to work toward a fairer economy. And I think that that actually is an important part of the overall transformation that we need to go through.
Chuck Collins, it has been a real pleasure to talk with you this hour. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Marianne.
Chuck Collins is the author of Born on Third Base. He's joined us from Boston this hour. You've been listening to NPR News. Stay tuned. We got more coming up on 1A at 10 o'clock.